Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews, press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
I'm opening.
We have
an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another Anatomy of a Movie here on Popcorn Talk. Today we're discussing a movie based off a book, based off of real-life events, called The Finest Hour. And it hits close to home for Dimitri, certainly, because another Massachusetts movie.
Another Massachusetts. Oh, bring them on.
You just haven't got... They just keep rolling in for you.
Thank God. Makes me feel at home with those accents.
They know you do this show.
Yeah, that's exactly that's exactly what it is.
I'm like, Dimitri will talk about this movie.
Sure.
That's right. And that's the voice of Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And, of course, Sarah Stretton.
Hello, hello.
And we're joined today by Dimitri's friends, but I'll let you introduce them because they're not only your friends, but they're our special guests for today for a very special reason.
For a very special reason, and yes, I'm proud to call them my friends, and we have the actual men from the Coast Guard, their actual Coast Guard, the Coasties.
But it goes deeper than that.
They actually worked... they were the consultants. They get credited on the film. They were the consultants. They were on set making sure that Craig Gillespie and crew got everything right as far as this rescue and the Coast Guard went. Thank you very much for being here today. It is an honor, privilege. We've never had consultants on, and I think with their stories, they will help bring the realism of what this movie tells about and portrays, and they're able to say, hey, this is...
They're going to give us the lowdown. They'll give us the lowdown. All of the background information.
Absolutely. This is like true behind the scenes about a true event that actually happened.
And so, yeah, so we're going to start there. Oftentimes we start with other facets of the movie, but let's start there, the science of it all, right? And do you want to introduce them by their name so everyone knows?
Sure. So we have John. Say hello, John, to the audience.
Hello, everyone.
What is your... just for everybody
rank
to know.
And
rank
and
sure. My name is John Pruitt, and I'm a commander of the U.S. Coast Guard.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
And then we have, we'll go Mike, when it's the same thing, please. Tell us who you are.
I'm Chief Warrant Officer Mike Lutz. I was one of the technical advisors on the movie.
Okay, and then we have Paul.
And I'm Paul Ruskowski. I'm a Chief Warrant Officer, and I was also one of the technical advisors on the movie.
And you gentlemen were meaning you were on set, fielded questions, made sure... things are being said
days.
Correctly,
yeah.
Things are in the right place, and things looked good and real so that it represented the Coast Guard in the best possible light.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
You know, I've got to say this, first starting off for me, that this actually has quite the all-star lineup of actors, because it was interesting enough, I spoke with William H. Macy, and he turned down a role because there was too much water and it was going to be cold. He was like, I'm not doing that.
So, and a lot of actors did say that this was some of the most physically demanding roles they've ever had because of the water. And to get to some questions with you guys, I would like to know, if any of you, how you got approached and kind of both by this movie, by this story, how much was it involved in your guys' training in getting into the Coast Guard? Do you know of these before filmmakers come on and say, hey, will you explain all of this to us? So your personal connection to the movie,
yeah,
anything
sure.
like that?
I'll start, I guess. And we actually were contacted by the producers and some representatives from Disney in about 2013. And they came to us with this idea of actually talking and telling the story from the book, basically, of The Finest Hours. And we said, hey, this is an awesome idea. I mean, it's truly one of the greatest stories in the Coast Guard. And so we want to go out and actually promote the Coast Guard to the world, and why not do it with some great storytellers like Disney?
I mean, with Disney and A-list actors, it's pretty much the best production team you can have.
So they came to us in 2013, and the whole process and kind of how our office works is that we actually get very in-depth. And the consulting is on set, but it really starts way before that. We actually start working like contracting and actually getting down to the meat of the fact of, hey, let's look at your script and actually even see if your script is even correct. And so we actually helped craft and shape a lot of aspects of the script to make sure it's actually what would happen with the Coast Guard. So,
did you guys have any, like, this needs to be included moments or anything that you were like, we want to shy away from that? Like,
yeah, I think Paul had a few.
I mean, I wouldn't call them this needs to be included moments, but I mean, I know there were several moments on set where, as we were filming, the questions would come up of, oh, what am I doing here? Yeah, right. Chris would walk through the door into the command center area, and he's just like, now what? What am I doing? So I had to walk him through, you know, this is what your character's doing. You're the officer of the day. You're going to be coming in, and you just were out checking the bar. You're checking conditions, walking around the station, making sure everything's okay. You're going to come in. You're going to log that. Wait, I mean, in the Coast Guard, I think the running joke is whenever something happens, just, yeah, log it. So, I mean, you sit there, and if you watch the movie, there's a couple guys that are always, like, sitting there writing things right down. They're like, what am I supposed to be writing? So I'm like, well, this is what you just saw, and every time we shot the scene, he would write it out, and they'd erase it, and he'd write it back out again, and the guy on the radio would sit there, be taking notes for, like, what he was hearing on the radio. So I think that was one of the bigger ones that they had questions about. Mm-hmm. The other issue on set is always, you know, people don't deal with military ranks and how we address each other a lot as actors. So it was really just helping them understand, okay, this person's a chief, this is an officer, this, you're going to call him sir, you're not going to have a buddy-buddy conversation with your commanding officer. You know, you're going to interject a sir every once in a while.
Right.
So...
It's really about the details and making, like, the life around the Coast Guard seem real.
It really
comes out. People aren't just standing there being like, let's just drink coffee on set.
Yeah. Well, because I think that's what loses our audience. I mean, sometimes, particularly like the military folks or the people that understand it, you know, everyone's kind of played, like, different video games. They hear the lingo or they see movies. You can get lost if it's just not said right. And that's one of the things that we want to make sure that comes across is, this is exactly how you need to say it.
So,
well, we spent a really long time working on the dialogue for the radio communications too.
Yeah.
Really,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. So, I wanted to ask. So, John, being the commanding officer, I wanted to ask too. First, what brought you, of all the military branches, why did you enlist in the Coast Guard, and then how did you get from when you first signed up? You were on a couple of ships, boats. Captain, and then how do you end up as a consultant? How do you end up in that? Like, how does that? What's that roadmap?
Yeah, so it's a really weird pathway, I'd say. So I was applying for college out of high school, and I applied to West Point and Air Force Academy, and, like, you know, University of Pennsylvania, just various colleges all over the place. And my dad said, "Hey, apply to the Coast Guard Academy." I was like, "I don't even know what the Coast Guard is, so why would I do that?" And of course my dad said, "We're gonna go visit." I was like, "That's not really necessary." So next thing you know, I went to go visit, and next thing you know, I'm at the academy, because I loved it. And I just love the mission of the Coast Guard, how we are primarily focusing on life saving, and we're one of the branches of the military, so we actually do national defense and homeland security now as part of the Homeland Security Department. But we're there as lifesavers. I mean, we're the guy that everyone calls when they're in need of help.
Right.
It doesn't matter if you're like in Katrina in New Orleans or you are offshore off of Catalina and you're sinking in your boat. So that kind of did it. And then leaving the academy, I went on to several ships. And it was happened to be captain of a ship, which was awesome. That was like the greatest thing in the world. So, you know, the last true kingdom is like the captain of a ship. So
yeah.
It's kind of cool. But I've also worked counter-narcotics. I worked in a lot of countries like throughout Central South America.
Right.
Essentially chasing down drug dealers. And
how does all of that bring you to film consultant office? I mean, it makes sense that there is one, and I'm sure all the military branches would have to have one. So how does all that bring you to L.A., to this office, and then everything you just said just describes what the Finest Hours is all about. It's a rescue. So that's just, how do you end up here in L.A.?
Well, you know, so I knew a guy. I mean, that's literally how it was. I knew a guy. The guy who had the job before I did,
yeah,
was a boss of mine like 10 years ago. And he was going to be moving on. And he said, hey, you know, when I heard about the job opening, I decided I'd apply for it. And he's like, hey, you know what? You're the guy. You should just do this. And I'm like, well, there's other people. He's like, no, I'm good. We'll just get you. And so that was it. And I'm like, well, I've never really done a lot of this before. He's like, you're good.
Are you a movie fan?
I am.
Then you're hired.
Yeah, I'm addicted to that.
That's great. So, that is fantastic.
So I knew a guy. That was really it.
Like every Hollywood story.
Yeah, always starts there. Yeah. Speaking of which, what we do is we really try and dive into the movie, not only how it's made, what our favorite scenes were, what character choices, things we like. Do you guys have any, as fans of this movie, any favorite scenes, standout performances, or choices that the director made that you really appreciate?
Mike, you want
to? Well, I enjoyed all the boat parts where the boat goes underwater. I mean, I read a lot of comments where people didn't think that was accurate when actually those boats were designed to do that.
Yeah, I want to talk about the boat for a little bit because I had read the book, and they really go into detail what this boat is all about. It's basically a tank. Yeah. Can you talk about, counter some of that criticism? Because there has been some criticism about, well, the boat's underwater for seemingly a lengthy long time. And I'm like, well, according to the book, it's able to do that. But we have the true guys here who know about this rescue and the boat. So tell us about that and dispel that horrible criticism.
Well, I'm a boat guy, and it's true. I mean, and if you want to hear from the face of the Coast Guard guy who's saying it, and I've been captain of 3 ships. And the idea of these boats being built so sturdily, you know, as you described, like a tank, it's a tank on water, because the rough conditions. And so if anything would happen, the boat rolled over, it would automatically roll itself back over. If it got pushed underwater like it did in the movie, it would pop right back up. So it's designed to go through the roughest weather and come out on top, no matter what.
And that one's still, the real one from that mission is still being used today, and they renamed it to Bernie, I believe.
No, so that one, the actual boat from the rescue is actually a historic landmark. It's in the Orleans area of Massachusetts. Sorry. And it has been restored. They found it just lying around and were like, hey, wait, this is the boat, you know. So they raised money and restored it. It's a wooden boat. It was built by the Coast Guard at the Coast Guard Yard in Baltimore. It's got 3 very tight, watertight compartments to keep it afloat in case it flips over. It's designed to completely flip over upside down and rewrite itself within several seconds. So just like you said, it's a tank on water.
And just so out clear, of wood. Its designation is the CG-36500.
Correct.
Right. Correct. So,
naysayers, stop. I think is the point of that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you folks can talk about the accuracy of this boat. And number one, Chatham, like Cape Cod during a blizzard, you don't want to be there.
No.
So, you know, and the way that the book described... trying to get out of Chatham Harbor, I mean, not only do they... In the wintertime, they contend with the blizzards, and then in the summertime, they have sharks, great whites. But trying to get over those breakers is a big deal, especially in a wooden boat such as this.
Well, you know, and even we have what we call surfmen, who are now the folks that drive these boats. And there's a special school that they go through in Oregon that they actually learn how to go over these bars, and the bars are like the really rough weather. So there's only a select group of people that have ever had this qualification, and I think right now we're about 220 people ever that are trained to do this.
I mean, just as a viewer of this movie, and I am not familiar with boat maneuvering or, you know, the skills that the Coast Guard really gets. I thought that the movie did a good job of kind of displaying different strategies that the boat goes through in getting through those waves. There seemed to be a variation in when it would go kind of like through the curve of a wave, sideways, when it would go straight through, when it would come out of the surf area. Like, it just seemed, as I was watching, it wasn't the same thing over and over again. It wasn't a boat going the same way over a wave. It was like this variety of angles.
Yeah, and it was getting battered and turned around. And did you have to talk with Chris Pine about, because, you know, he was using a lot of the throttle to, you know, to navigate the waves. Was there any advice that you gave that was given to him to say, this is how this might be attacked, you know?
Yeah, well, I think, either Mike or...
We actually took him down to the small boat station in Long Beach, San Pedro, and introduced him to the bosun mates, the people that today are the part that he was playing in the movie. And he got a lot of great information from them and instruction on how to drive a boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we also took him out to Chatham, and he got to talk to the guys out in Chatham. And to this day, Chatham is still the one station in the Coast Guard that has very specialized boats just for that station to get over that bar. So, right. I mean, even to this day, it's still a very dangerous thing to do.
Right. Yeah. For the boat design, because it's been, you know, decades since the type of boat that they used to now, and, you know, technology has advanced so much. What have you seen any technological advances in these boats today that would have helped greatly back then?
We used much stronger screws to keep the compass on.
Yeah. Right.
There's well, that. I mean, you've learned.
Yes. Exactly.
Learned from the lessons.
Has the design changed
well, you know,
so much?
I think the overall concept is still there.
Yeah.
Designs change to kind of keep up with modern technology. Now we've got GPS.
Okay.
You know, so we've got the navigation charts. So you would know where you are everywhere you go. We even have night vision cameras on the boats. And spotlights that are remotely controlled, so the crew could actually stay inside the boat and not get beat by the weather to go out and do these jobs.
Let me
ask you this, because you know the compass was a big thing, right? And you know, I equate it to, I don't know if the analogy makes sense in your head, but now there's so many teleprompters, right, for TV hosts.
Sure.
And the old joke is that if that TV prompter goes down, they can't do their job. And you know, so speaking to that, like, take it from today, you know, if the GPS goes down, could you guys navigate? And also tying it back to the movie, how was he able to guide himself to that ship? And then
I mean, I'll tell you, I had a very similar scenario, not as crazy weather-wise, but say lack of information and things like that. And we were trying to save a father and a son, and I was the captain of a ship. And literally what happened, the father and son said, "We're in this position, our boat just sank, help us." And that was the last thing we heard. So we actually didn't go to that position because one of the guys said, "I don't think they're there. I think we should go over here and start searching." So we literally passed all the other search vessels and went the opposite direction. And we found them truly by luck. That was just lucky. I mean, someone wanted them to live. And that's really, I think, kind of what happened in this case is, with all technology, it really boils down to sometimes just sheer luck.
And there's an interesting mention of that throughout the film.
Yeah.
Like, the lack of luck or lack of possibility luck to the change, the arc that maybe it is lucky or there is some greater meaning. I mean, that's a very Disney-esque theme about it's a company that's always thrived on themes of destiny, themes of people being told they can't succeed at something and overcoming, like, whatever that obstacle is.
Absolutely.
Right, and I think there was a line in the movie where the crew asked Bernie, like, "How did you find us?" And he was like, "Oh, I was just, you know, minding where the wind was taking us and this and the waves and drifts and whatnot." So was that, like, really authentic to what you guys would do?
Absolutely. I mean,
well now we have computer systems that figure out where the set and drift and everything is going to put a boat, but it's a much larger overview of the rescue, where you'll have, like, a vessel traffic center, which is almost like a
like an air traffic control tower
on the water or looking
but,
over the water.
You know, but we still learn all the old skills.
We still
learn, like, you know, using a sextant and shooting the stars, because just in case you lose everything, you can still get home.
There's a lot of industries that do that. Like, you'll talk about also, like, airline pilots, where it's like they're only allowed to land every so often on autopilot because they still have to be able to do it manually.
Sure.
And so that's normally why you get a rocky landing. Sometimes it's keeping up those skills, and a lot of different industries
absolutely
continue to do that.
Yeah, and which brings me to, so let's talk about, I mean, we could talk about... I want to talk about the movie as a whole. Mm-hmm. I had read the book, and so there were certain embellishments and part of the narrative regarding the love story, which is fine, because Halliday Granger, I think, really is a shining star in this movie. But that was made up because, in truth, Bernie Weber had been married for 3 years. Mm-hmm. His wife was bedridden with the flu.
Sure.
There's not a whole hell of a lot of drama there. So I understand why they introduce a love story. For me, the most important part, and that, as great of a part as it was, it adds sentiment and heart to the movie, but going into it, the rescue attempt needed to be real.
Yeah.
As being the technicians, and not that you would say, well, we did a shitty job, but I want to know, like, once you saw the finished product, does it get your stamp of approval? Do you go... They did it. They did us justice, and they did the rescue attempt justice. That, to me, was the most important part.
Sure. I'd say yes. I mean, I've done rescues, and that's exactly what I would have done. There's nothing different. And it's tricky. It's dangerous. And you're concerned that people are going to come down the ladder, and they're going to fall in the water. And then once they fall in the water, you're never going to see them again. Or you're going to hit them with the boat, and you're going to crush them. Which is one of the aspects of the book that actually did happen in real life. So it's real. That's it. I mean, that's one of the great things, I think, what our office helps to bring to these movies. Mm-hmm. And also what we want to do is we want to tell the true story.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't want the public to see something that isn't true, because it doesn't help. I mean, if you want to see what the Coast Guard does, and if you want to join the Coast Guard, or you want to, talk to your congressman and give us more money. You know, all those things. See what we have to do and understand why it's important.
Go ahead.
And I would say that there's sometimes that the true story is almost
absolutely
unbelievable.
It
looks like something that Hollywood had written, and people look at it and go, no way. and the truth of it is, no, that's how it went down.
That's
really
how it went down.
Well, that goes exactly back to the boat design dilemma, which is that it seems almost fanciful because it seems like something that... it's almost unbelievable, but it is a key component as to what makes this story interesting is that the Coast Guard is able to do those things. And I think that on that level, I think that this movie did really well. I think also my favorite thing is how they created the dual storylines, the flipping back and forth, with really having a protagonist both on the Coast Guard and on the ship, and making them very different people. I thought that was one of the strongest story dynamics this movie had, because it made it so that you were still connected whenever your storyline was switching.
Yeah.
Whichever boat you were on, you still cared about... at least one person involved.
And, well, Phil, you were going to bring something up.
Sarah reads my mind.
Oh, there we go. and I wanted to... what I find special about this movie, too, is, you know, I'm a big fan of, like, Top Gun, but Top Gun is truly commercial, fine entertainment. I'm not entirely sure all of that is true. This movie works as...
Rescue.
Rescue. The Coast Guard. But, of course that was true. But Finest Hours is such a different movie because it's great commercial entertainment, but it tells of a true story about true men. Chris Pine described him, his character as, he walks into work, he punches a clock. He's just like, he's like a blue-collar worker. That's his job. That's what he does. He doesn't see himself as a hero. Bernie Weber from the book never really saw himself as a hero. He rarely ever talked about the incident once it was done and over. And this movie really depicts, like, this job, what it is. You're right, when we're on the Pendleton. And I want to talk a little bit about the Pendleton, too, because some people say, well, it's split in half. How does this float? Paul, you had experience with the building of the boat. So let's talk about a little bit about the science of how it stays afloat for such a long time. I want to talk about the movie set, obviously, behind the scenes, about the building of the Pendleton and the breaking of the Pendleton. So tell us a little bit about that.
Can I touch on the science?
Yeah, sure. Science-wise, I mean, the biggest thing is what we call... compartmental integrity, which is when you see, if you see movies or in real life, you see these boats with these big heavy metal doors and they screw them closed or whatever. That's to keep water out. So you basically create an airtight compartment. And so where the ship split, it was fortunately enough that it was on the other side of those watertight compartments. So kind of like if Titanic had watertight compartments, it wouldn't have sunk. That's what wouldn't have. So, so instead, the Pendleton was able to stay afloat, unlike Titanic.
Right.
As for the grounding of the ship and the steering into the developing of a rudder with chains and such, how is that... Is that reasonable to think possible?
Or I would say
the realism involved in there?
There's a 50-50 on that one, because as far as the rudders go, you always have an ability to create an alternate system. Like outside of like the actual hydraulic system, you can generally rig up like they did chain falls, you know, and manually do it. It's very, very wouldn't have been that fast. It would have been like just very, very slow process. And running in the ground, now they really didn't do that in real life, but I'll tell you, that's one of those scenarios that being a captain of a ship, you think about that if your ship's going to go down and you're, say, close to a beach, do you run your ship aground to keep it from sinking, or do you just sink? And the reality is you would run it aground.
Yes.
And then it's better to be able to let your guys walk on the beach than it is to have to put them in a boat.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, if I'm correct, is there is little known about Casey Affleck's character, Ray.
Right.
So he didn't have much to go off of. And even in the book, they don't go much into that character. And what I loved about his portrayal and the way that that character was written is he, too, is, in a sense, an anti-hero. He's an engineer, and he didn't really want an authority position on this boat, but he wasn't a guy that complained about it. You know, he just, like, sort of kind of like, okay, so that happened. How as an engineer do I have to get this out of, you know, how do I fix this? And now I've got to try to, like, talk to these crew, and I loved his performance because it wasn't over the top at all. He was very, in a sense, like, sort of subdued and almost quiet to the extent of, like, I got to think through this. How am I going to keep these guys alive? Because that means I stay alive, too. Sure. So, but your experience, well, tell us your experience about, they actually, on set, they built the Pendleton and broke
so
the Pendleton.
So they built, the Pendleton set was in several pieces. You had that section with the mess deck and the kitchen and some of the berthing areas. That was one section that they could put on a gimbal. There was the top deck section that they had built on a gimbal that they brought in later. So each section they kind of filmed down differently. The engine room itself was its own set, and the thing was huge. It was about three to four stories tall on a gimbal so that it could rotate about 20 degrees, fill up with water. You look at it on the outside and it looks like it's a giant bathtub.
It's just wonderful. Steel. It's just wonderful, you know, to be part of Disney, isn't it?
And
it's awesome.
Money. When I showed up on set, they were just finishing filming in there, the scene where it, you know, there's explosions and water and the chains part and all that. And I was looking at it, I'm like, we have crew guys, damage control guys that would love to get on this thing and just play, because it was so authentic looking when you walked in.
Right.
They had water shooting out the crack and just mattresses and all the damage control stuff that we learned being on a boat. You know, that's what we learned.
So
you know, you stuff the hole as much as you can.
Like, we're going to use
gone.
This as a training
recycled.
Facility.
So they even employed actual technique that, say, the Coast
absolutely.
Guard, if you were
absolutely.
In a boat.
Or any vessel.
Any vessel.
And they got a lot of help with some of the outfitting of that set from the USS Salem, which is down the river in Quincy where they filmed. And then the side of the ship that the guys come down the ladder on, they built that. That was a facade, a steel facade that they had
that's
the crack
awesome.
In that they brought over and put into the tank, and they would drive the boat up next to it and dip the guys. In fact, the guy that plays Tiny,
Abraham Ben Ruby,
right? The guy that actually falls though was one of the Marine coordinators that we worked with several times. They dressed him up in a fat suit, and he did the backflip and kind of the what did they call it, the sink out as he called it. So the set was that set was amazing to see it full of water and
it
on
looked
fire
amazing. And how long were you a part of the consulting time period? Like, were you there every day for a certain duration, or did they bring you in only when they needed you?
It was about 4 years of every once in a while somebody would go out to that area for a couple weeks.
Hey, we have a question.
Yeah.
I was on set 11 days while we were filming all the interior of the Coast Guard station scenes.
Okay.
I did talk to some of the cast about what they would be doing on the boat, a little bit more about their characters. And then you were
I was there for about a week and a half or so of some other filming aspects.
On location.
On location, mm-hmm. Right. And then before that, there's still a lot of historical basis and, I guess, imagery and pictures and just even talking to historians. And so we did a lot of that research really for the last 3 years of just finding the mm-hmm. information and just kind of culling it all together.
Helping get the radio stuff right.
Yeah. Helping get the radio stuff right, getting the exterior. They actually filmed at Station Chatham where we still have an active unit and making the exterior of that look accurate and
right, and even the uniforms. So that was
mm-hmm. uniforms.
So that was, because one of the crazy things is when you think back to history, we keep a lot of our records and files, but 50 years from now, hopefully someone can pull up what things look like because they just click a button. But right. all that stuff is in a big file drawer if it even exists, because who cared what that looked like? So people just threw most of the stuff away. Yeah. So it took a lot of research for us to find it, and we use our historians.
And speaking of history, just again, I don't think that people quite understand the historic value and nature of this rescue, what it means to the Coast Guard, why it makes this book and movie so important is that because to this day, if I'm correct, well, you fill in the blank about the historical.
This is truly the greatest small boat rescue of the Coast Guard. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they recovered so many people and had them on that boat that shouldn't have been able to hold that many people, it just boggles everyone's mind. So 50 years later, 60 years later, we're still going, that shouldn't have happened.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They, just from the fact that they found the boat and the crew was still there, shouldn't have happened.
So. Yeah, well, we were watching it, because Phil and I, we saw it together, and, throughout the whole time I'm saying out loud, I was like, those guys aren't going to fit on that little boat. How is that possible? But it's amazing. Yeah. I was like, 33, because they kept saying out loud, 33 guys, they can hardly fit those four.
Right,
yeah.
And it's, so visually, when you see, the rescue in the end, you're like, wow, they really did it.
Well, the Coast Guard, everything is numbered by size. So the 36-500, it's a 36-foot boat. So... you have the four crew, and the boat was designed to hold 12 with the four crew. So they fit another 32 on board from the Pendleton. So you had 36 guys on a 36-foot boat.
Wow. So, foot per one. Guy.
Right. One person. Yeah. 1 foot.
There you go. There's your math. Were you guys part of the editing process as well? Because I know you guys talked about being there early on.
Sure.
But in a way, in the filmmaking process, you can have the greatest stuff shot in the world, and then you get to the editing process, you can go downhill from there. So
absolutely. That's one of the crazy things that we think is awesome for our job, is that we actually get to go in and help to ensure the accuracy in the editing room. So even before the rest of the world sees it, we see it and go in and actually kind of make comments. So we're not looking to take over creative control ever, but we want to make sure it's right. And so...
Do you have that moment, though, where you get so invested and you try it, you're like, I wish you guys did this. Not, again, not necessarily from the Coast Guard perspective, but just your own invested interest in it.
I'm seeing some very slight nods.
No, I'll shake my head now. I think so. I mean, because we love it. This is what we do. I mean, so we want to make it perfect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do get into that constraints of, what's reality versus Hollywood? What looks better on film?
Yeah.
And so we've got to be able to be compromising, I guess, to make it.
And try to step back.
Yeah.
Sit a little, just.
We've got to say.
We understand.
We get you.
Yeah.
There's a point that it's it is a movie, and there is an aspect of you know, my biggest worry, I'm going to throw this into it. My biggest worry was I was going to see this film, and I thought that a trap I could fall into is repetitiveness. Mm-hmm. I think it is, you know, as an audience member now, some people are used to the sky falling down, and you never know. And it all, and like, if you're talking about action movies, it's always about the next new way to, like, kill someone. Because you can't just shoot someone in the head in a movie anymore. Like, that is not enough. It's always, like, you have to make something interesting. It's just, we see so much, and we see so much so often. So I was like, this movie could fall in the trap of being repetitive. It's, I know I was going into it. I knew it was going to be about 2 hours. And I thought that the way they battled that was by really, again, creating those two storylines, but also coming up with doing the running ashore, doing the needing to be able to turn a ship however many degrees so you could bounce back and forth, mm-hmm. and you weren't staying on the same ship so long to the point that its actions were still interesting and not repetitive.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Like, they didn't want to repeat it being the perfect storm again, because mm-hmm. that had happened. And from some of the marketing, you sort of kind of get a perfect stormish kind of feel, mm-hmm. in a sense. To me, another way that this movie succeeds is it's a throwback movie. This is the type of movie that they would have made in the 50s or Absolutely. The 60s. We've talked about this, like Gary Cooper or even James Stewart could have played, like a younger James Stewart could have played Chris Pine's character. It went to a much more humanistic, like these people weren't like bigger than life. They were, mm-hmm. they're real characters, much like that. That's what Jim Stewart was all about.
And something about giving their protagonists flaws.
Yeah,
in absolutely. A way. For instance, they took Chris Pine's character. You know, he's the one who is going out and doing something that's just so brave. But the way they set him up with, like, his relationship to his commanding officer, sure. his rule-fallingness, this kind of meek,
which he was like, though.
Attitude,
yep. which he was
that
like.
He had. But that was very different than an Avenger coming in and saving the
Absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely.
Right. Which is very the modern take.
But also to add to that, they did give him the backstory, and they gave the audience the backstory that he came back from, like, a failed mission.
Yeah.
Where mm-hmm. people did lose their lives. So it also added to the audience, like, okay, can he go out and redeem right. himself in a way?
Yeah.
And because he had that looming over his head.
Well, not even redeem. It's like, is he just stupid? Again, you know, is he just trying to make up for this? And, you know, blindly doing it, but he's going to fail again.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that you could see hanging over his head like a dark cloud.
No
pun intended there. But, you know, it also really showcased to me is, like, you're right. There was a realism to his character. He had his misgivings. But the other thing that the movie makes a point of us knowing is that they're the B team. The A team, even the A team says, we ain't going through the breakers.
Right.
Screw that, we're going to drive around. Yeah. Like, we're not going through the breakers. The B team was given given the suicidal mission. And they, like, even the commanding officer is not believing that they're even going to make it out of the breakers. But you got to go. And there's a line, it was in the trailer, it's in the movie, and it's like, listen, the Coast Guard, they give you orders to go out. They never tell you got to come back. Mm-hmm. And to me, I like that line. It may come off cheesy, but Chris Pine delivers it with a good realism, and you understand the plight of what these sailors have to do right. to get out there.
I mean, I'll even talk about that line.
Please.
Yeah. That line was a true unofficial motto of the Coast Guard. You know, no one will ever say that's what our motto was, because it's never been our motto. Officially, it's Semper Paratus, which is always prepared. But every coastie would tell you that the job was to go out and try to save someone and literally be damned if I make it back. Yeah. Because I got to go out. I've got to go try my best to go save that person. And if I don't make it back, then, oh well, I'll get a military funeral. Oh.
I mean, the line itself actually stems from Pea Island, which was the first lifeboat station that was manned all by African Americans. Mm-hmm. Richard Etheridge, who now has a cutter named after him.
Absolutely.
There was a big storm. They had a ship, and his crew was going, hey, boss, we can't get out. There's no way we can go out. And the story is that Richard Etheridge opened up the book, you know, looked at the blue book, and he said, blue book says we got to go out. Doesn't say a damn thing about coming back in. And it's true, the actual manual would say that every effort had to have been made to effect a rescue before you called it off and said, we can't do it.
Yeah. Speaking to that, I think that for me, I hadn't read the book and wasn't really familiar with the story before this movie. I realized halfway through that I was curious about the ending. And I started recalling and not only had that line already passed, but I started trying to recall the marketing. And to me, it kept ringing in my head as, like, the great, or, like, one of the most brave or daring small boat rescue. And I was like, was the word attempts in there? I kept just being like, it never really was success. Like, rescue, like, completed. It kind of was left ambiguous.
It was weird. It was like they didn't want to give away the ending.
It works for me because I didn't know the ending, but I realized that was kind of something that they were pushing. Right. That, like, this is just, they're trying, they're making the best effort. You don't know if they are coming back, and I thought that was also done really well.
There's just Everest kind of did that, and obviously that story didn't turn out so well. But I like that kind of where you don't know the predictability of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, I personally knew because I went to D23 back in August 2015, and that's where I first heard of this movie, and they told the audience the preface of what it was, and they kind of did spoil it. They're like, and it was one of the first successful small boat missions. Mm-hmm.
But they left that out. It seemed to me that they left it out of the marketing, that it was really successful.
I'll even tell you. So I think one thing is that when you look at, in terms of what we define as success, and what even Bernie Weber defined as success was...
Everybody comes home.
Everybody comes home. But not everybody came home. Mm-hmm. Tiny died. And that haunted that crew.
Yeah.
Still does. Andy Fitzgerald, who's still alive today, is still haunted by the fact that they didn't save the one guy.
Right.
And what they don't show in the movie and what really happened was that he was actually crushed between the Coast Guard boat and the Pendleton.
And that was actually in the rough cut.
Yeah.
That we saw
in August. It's a little bit too graphic. If you look
I could see you. I think Tiny died was different.
I think Disney does a little too.
For the audience I feel like they aimed at for this movie, it seemed more of a kind of family affair and not really... Like, they didn't go for the gruesomeness in this movie. Sure. They didn't, and as dramatic and crazy as Storm was, it wasn't super dark and everyone turning against each other. And so I think that it makes sense for tonally why they didn't include that.
Yeah.
Because it would have been, like, I thought it was shocking enough how he died.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That you, it didn't, if it had been that much more.
Yeah.
Even though it's not true, I think it would have really shooken up.
And again, being the throwback movie, because the movie to me too, outside of its heroism, the movie does have its tenderness and heart that they build up in this romance, which is definitely a 50s movie kind of a romance.
Absolutely.
That works. Mm-hmm. And Halliday Granger, as I said earlier on, was a, you know, she's a bright star. I mean, I really want to see her in more movies, but she carries this off because not only could she be tender, sweet, loving, she could be, I'm going to run into the Coast Guard station and I'm going to, like, talk to the commanding officer there. So I really loved how she could be strong in one moment and then be tender, loving, care. She pulled it off. And I really bought into that love story, even though that's not the way that it played out. But to me, that's a special part of the movie because it gives Bernie Weber the character in this movie. Hey, I need to get back. It's that lifeline.
I like the idea that they really gave her a very strong feminine role, especially back in those days where it wasn't as pronounced, one could say, because also I believe that scene was fictionalized for just the movie and storytelling to help build that relationship.
Right.
But I liked it, and it really gave her empowerment. And even she had another female friend that helped her along the way. So, like, I liked how they gave strong female roles in this film.
Yeah.
Well, and the history is, Miriam was a strong person. Her asking Bernie to marry him, that happened. Yeah. She did that. She picked the day. The character was played really well by Holiday. She got to talk to Bernie's daughter a lot, and she took her around Chatham and talked a lot about it.
So we, we're going to wrap up in a little bit regarding consulting, but I want to, each one of you must have your own special story with consulting in this movie. And I also want to know what this movie means to you. Not the book. Have you all read the book? Yes. So you're all familiar with the book. So, but we are a movie show. I want to know what this movie means personally to you. What you think it means to the Coast Guard, and what moments were you on set that you were like, you know, this is going to work. This they're getting it right. And did you have a particular favorite moment? And your thoughts on this movie, your personal thoughts about this movie, and what it means to you.
Jump on in.
Yeah. Let's go first.
Well, I love the most about this movie, it was like new nostalgia. It's like something I would have watched with my dad back when I was little, you know, and it's something that I'm watching. And actually, he came and watched a screening with us. So it's like a throwback, even though it's fresh. And I think that was the thing I loved the most about everything we did with it. I did a lot of the work with the lawyers and everything, so the onset stuff was much more fun. So go ahead.
I agree with Mike in terms of the throwback nature of the movie, and I grew up with, like, you know, like you said, the Jimmy Cagney days, and I always think this always kind of strikes me like a From Here to Eternity type of, and so just like that whole grandness of scale and the smallness of the people and how they still overcome the odds. And that's what really got me. And I think my moment was when I was at Chatham and it was actually filming all the winter scenes. And I actually went up to the lighthouse and actually was looking down from the lighthouse just kind of watching the whole expanse of the production and everything going on. And it just was incredible because it was like, this is great for the Coast Guard to be put on display and telling a story that most people don't know. And personally, I think this isn't just the Bernie Weber story. This is a Coast Guard story. This is a story that could be happening right now and has happened right now and is going to happen in 5 minutes from now. This is what every single Coast Guard person that puts their lives in danger to go out and save people without any care that, you know what, they may be putting their lives in danger. They may not get home. They want to come home. Everybody wants to come home. But they're there to do their job, and they want to try to help others. And so that's really struck me as this is a moment for hopefully people to see and appreciate the service that I love, that I've dedicated a lot of time to. So
awesome.
Great.
I also love the throwback nature of how we filmed it and how it was edited and just the storytelling behind it. I love the fact that it's a story from the small boat side. We don't get to see that a lot in our realm. We get a lot of, I want to do stuff with the helicopters or the bigger boats. So we have our special place in our hearts for the small boat guys and the Black Hawk guys. Yeah. There were a couple times on set where I would sit there with the producers and we sit in Video Village and watch the things going down.
Can you explain for Video Village?
So Video Village is where the producers, the director, Craig spent a lot of time actually on the set, close to the cameras. So it was mostly just the producers, the dialect coach, and me sitting there watching what the cameras were seeing, the various cameras, and, you know, listening in on headsets as to what the dialogue was going on. And there were a couple of times where we were filming this and just the take went so well, and whether it made it into the movie or not, there were a couple of scenes where he's talking about going over the bar, and that was one scene that stuck out in my head where we all kind of looked at each other after one of the takes and went, "This is going to be pretty good. I can't wait to see this on the big screen."
That's awesome.
You know, where you're looking at it on a screen that's like maybe this big. And you're just kind of enthralled in the performance and what's going on, and you kind of lose sight of, hey, I'm on a movie set. We're actually filming this. And then because we filmed it in an old shipyard that was still somewhat active, randomly we would get a train that would come through, and the horn would sound and the bells would ding, and invariably it was a really dramatic moment that we were trying to get the emotion on, and all of a sudden you get and Chris starts laughing and everybody goes, "Oh, the trains of Chatham," you know. So that was one moment that kind of stuck with me through the filming, was the trains that would randomly come through while we were filming the most dramatic scenes.
Always.
What favorite New England food?
Oh, that's easy. Fried clams
and bellies.
Yeah.
fried clams, strips, actually.
Strips.
Oh. And chocolate chip milkshakes, because those all go together. Perfectly.
Fair enough.
Harpoon
there
Brewery.
Harpoon Brewery.
That was,
there you go. And, you know, on a more serious note, if you know, because this is about bringing awareness to the Coast Guard in some aspects, what's the best way they can help support the Coast Guards? Where do they go to do that?
Sure. I'd say the easiest way to find out more about the Coast Guard is...
Online.
Online. Two websites. GoCoastGuard.com and www.uscg.mil.
I think the best way to support the Coast Guard is when you go out on a boat, wear a life jacket so we don't have to come save you.
Exactly.
Yes.
Absolutely.
There you go. Wear a life jacket.
Yeah.
Tell people where you're going.
Well, I was telling you, too, the story. My uncle, Matthew Marty Panos, as I know, during that time, he's a Coast Guard. I dedicate, actually, this show to him. I was telling you, you actually called out the boat before I even told you, because he was on an icebreaker, and he would, from South Boston, they would actually either go to the North Pole, or the South Pole cut, and you had said, was he on the East Wind? Yeah. Said, that's exactly the boat he was on. He was on the East Wind, so... yeah, I have a little bit of Coast Guard blood. I know how to swim. That's about and by
that's
family.
Good.
Yeah, I know how to swim. So, but no, it's been fantastic. You folks have. This is what our show is all about. We love movies, and it's great to know and to have you as guests, because you're giving us a side of the movies that I didn't even really know existed. Like, you know, you hear about the Army, but for this movie, it seems to be so special, and I wanted, after reading the book, the rescue to be real and not to be blown up for Hollywood's sake. And you guys did a great job. I mean, you know, and the movie, I think it's my favorite of January. I really think this movie could have been black and white. You know, as a nostalgia movie, it could have been in black and white, and it's still, like you said, From Here to Eternity, and. It had just all those qualities of past movies. And, yeah, I wanted to thank you folks for what you did in the movie, for coming here to our awesome show. And thank
and
you very
what
much.
What you do in life.
Yeah. So. Thank you very much.
Thanks so we're gonna take a quick short break, and then when we come back, we'll talk more storyline of The Finest Hours.
Hi, my name is Adrienne Snow, and one of the great influences of my life has been Angela Bassett. Growing up, she was a big influence in my household. She was in Waiting to Exhale and What's Love Got to Do with It and Strange Days, and seeing a black woman, you know, for me as a six-year-old, an older black woman, you know, by the time she started her career, she's already in her mid-30s, really excel and kind of break racial divides in terms of playing love interest to people outside of her race, in terms of going into certain demographics you wouldn't normally see black people in, that really pushed me to want to become an actor, and so that's why I did it. So she's someone I really do recommend honoring during this month of Black History.
Hey guys, it's Lim Gonzalez here, and we're celebrating Black History Month, and someone that really influenced me growing up, I have to say, is Morgan Freeman. The reason why I say Morgan Freeman is because Morgan Freeman is someone that started late as far as getting his career off the ground. And I myself can relate to that so well, because here I am as a host here at AfterBuzz, and I'm what you consider late in my career. I just turned 40 years old, and for me to just be getting started, people would say, oh, you know, it's a young man's game, but I epitomize Morgan Freeman because he's such a well-respected actor in the business, and like I said, because he got his start so late, it gave me the confidence to do what I'm now doing at this late age and stage in the game. So I appreciate him. I salute him for Black History Month. There it is.
Hey, I'm Stephon Wallace, and if I had to choose somebody that is an African-American actor that influenced my life, I mean, movies in general influenced me growing up, as an only child, but Eddie Murphy is who stands out. I remember creeping to my mom's room. I was like outside the room on the floor because I wanted to hear Eddie Murphy raw. We weren't allowed to watch it, but I just wanted to hear it. It was like something, you know, we had never seen before. I vividly remember being able to watch him play Axel Foley in Beverly Hills Cop. It was revolutionary. I mean, he was my sort of personality. It's like, it's what I wanted to emulate. He said everything I could ever imagine wanting to say. He did all the things that were outside the lines, which is exactly who I've been for the rest of my life. Thank you, Eddie. You know, but everything. I mean, Golden Child, it goes on and on. Eddie Murphy, he gave me my wings. He gave me my stance. And he's a person who's influenced me.
Hello.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. That's right. Going from the Coast Guard to celebrating Black History Month on Popcorn Talk in collaboration with, of course, the Black Hollywood Live Network. So you got a couple of those filmmakers and what they mean to various people in the Black Hollywood Live network and community.
Awesome.
You know, it was wonderful chatting with them. You know, I think we got a lot.
It's a pleasure to have them come in. And yes, Marissa said it's everything that they do just in their lives, but also to give us the background of
this
movie.
It was great behind this. For me, for a show, it's great behind the scenes stuff that you're not going to get anywhere else. No. You just won't.
Absolutely.
I've seen a ton of interviews on this movie. Not once did they have a Coast Guard guy on. And so I think we got a great scoop.
It's great because, you know, watching the film, it took me a long time to realize it was the U.S. Coast Guard that was helping along, because the way that they portrayed Bernie is like he was in normal day clothing. Right. Like, it took me a while to figure out what his job position was until they, you know, mentioned it. So, and then now realizing after the fact, I was like, okay, these are the guys to look for.
Yeah.
These are the guys that helped us along the way.
Yeah. Yeah, let's take a quick step back. You know, let's get into story. You know,
sure.
We hinted at moments and things.
And overall impressions. And
yeah, I mean, I enjoyed this movie. My only true criticism was that the subtitles were so damn small and so damn quick. I was like, I had to squint.
I was like, read faster. Also, we saw in IMAX.
The February 1951. There weren't many.
Yeah, yes. We saw it in IMAX, so in fairness, the text might have looked smaller than a normal viewing experience.
Okay.
But losing your eyesight.
Definitely not. I asked Marissa, is this tiny?
It was fairly small.
So that was your overall impression as well?
I could read it.
I just thought, here's the thing, I bring that up because, again, for what the movie is, and to kind of, because that's one of the first things we see, I thought, like, just, it's just a general thing for any movie, just make it a little bit bigger.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. No, because that's what you're coming into. Because the movie is so good overall,
right.
that to let that kind of, why?
Yeah. An establishing shot.
Why let that be a
shot.
Thing?
Yeah. An establishing shot
this
should
be
well
This movie had one of
pronounced.
Those things that got under Phil's skin a little bit.
You know, it's, because, and at the end, right, when they're showing the pictures, I thought that also was quick and small.
Yeah.
And so, when especially, fine, I didn't read the date of 1951, exactly what the year, and so on and so forth. But at the end, when they're showing those images, I wanted to read it, and I wanted to see it. And it was too fast, too small. So
Sure.
Well, for those who are watching our show, we actually do have authentic photos that can be shown to the audience of the actual crew members and the boat that were a part of it, so... So if you're listening in iTunes, definitely check out the YouTube video.
Absolutely.
So this is, what are we calling this, the mess hall?
Yes, this is mess hall with the original four
And
men.
This photo was in the end of the film.
Yes, we had.
So, but that was your, but ultimately you enjoyed this movie.
I thought the movie was great. And again, so to make that my nitpick, number one, it makes this movie fantastic. Number two, I just, you know, it is a deep nitpick for me in that regard, because I was so vested in it, and especially at the end, I wanted to know what kind of what happened. Mm-hmm. But and you know, Sarah mentioned it, and like I joked about, she's a mind reader. I love the dichotomy.
Yeah,
there were two heroes simultaneously. It wasn't because we've seen before. Okay, gotta just rescue these guys. Right. And they're like, I'm digging on water.
Yeah,
help.
Yeah,
you know,
you saw two people struggling. You saw two forces struggling, one to save, one to survive, and it played off really well. Marissa, do you want to
take it for your overall?
Yeah, overall, I really enjoyed this film. I knew what it was about, thanks to D23 convention. I was very excited to watch it because, as I don't really want to call this a disaster movie, but like a daring action movie in a way where like there's a lot happening, people fighting nature. That's always fun to watch.
Yeah.
And as terrible as it was that they actually had to go through that, it was very visually intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
Watching it, I felt freezing the whole time.
Yeah.
Fairness, we were in a really cold theater, but...
But I brought my jacket. I told her, bring a jacket, because
it's very
cold.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the two anti-reluctant anti-heroes.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that, but I also did enjoy Miriam's storyline, too.
Oh, I love me too.
Because going from two chaotic locations, going from the tanker to the small lifeboat, and then having Miriam's easy breather of scenes, I really enjoyed what she brought because it helped the audience just go through the film. If we had a full hour and a half of just water, it'd be too overwhelming.
Yeah, and that character, too. And again, I didn't have a problem with them inventing the story because that character grounds things because it gave something on the mainland that gave a hope. That gave, like, where something was vested for somebody. So, you mentioned, in your comments, you were talking, it just escaped my mind, which you were talking about the dichotomy, and you were talking about, you'll have to bring it back up again, because...
I think Sarah was talking about the dichotomy.
No, you had mentioned something that, about, like, Bernie and Casey and such, but...
About them being anti-heroes?
Well... Above and beyond anti-heroes, there was something else that was, again, like, in the book, you don't really get a lot about what was on the Pendleton, because they didn't exactly know, you know, and that's why there isn't much on that character Ray and what Casey Affleck brought to his character. You really sort of appreciate, and again, he wasn't a larger-than-life guy. Mm-hmm. He's not a guy that's in the military. He's just an engineer in this boat. Who, it's like, okay, you know, we have these people fighting it out, and I guess I gotta sort of kind of figure out how we're gonna stay afloat while everybody else is fighting.
Well, he became senior ranking officer because everyone else who was above him died. So he was, in a way, forced into that position. And that's what I liked with the two main male protagonists, that they were set up because of other outside reasons.
Right.
And that's what also, as an audience member, I enjoyed, because it wasn't like they did it because they had to.
Right.
And because they, in a sense, you could see a little bit that they didn't want to, but they stepped up. And that's why I really enjoyed just like the nature of people like overcoming even if they didn't want to.
What I liked about Casey's character is, because again, he could have, you know, let people have a choice, but the fact that he made everyone be together no matter what, because that was also part of, you can in some way say it was selfish because he needed all those men, but when he goes out there with that axe and chops that, you know, he is saving their lives too. I thought that was a really strong moment in general, both acting, writing, so on.
And apparently that was also fictionalized because he actually didn't do that in real life. Although the men did contemplate whether they should take their lifeboats, none of them were ever actually released.
No, no. But it was dangerous. Like, they couldn't do that. So
I think that overall for this movie... when I left it, I really enjoyed it. I thought that, especially the center chunk of, like, going over the bar and bringing the Pendleton to that shoal or whatever it was, I thought all of that was really engaging. I thought it had very high stakes. I really liked a lot of the roles. But for me, I think that this film... It's easy to actually for me to nitpick a lot of things on this film, but I think it's because of the genre, in a way. I like that they made it a throwback, and I liked that, in general, this would be a movie that I could really recommend to my family, to my parents, to my grandparents. I think for a younger audience, it's there's a couple parts where it drags, and I think that, for me, there was a couple of characters who would have completely been cut out. I also had some nitpicks about the sound for me, because it would get so loud and then drop out of, at least in my theater, the sound would just the soundtrack would just drop out, and it would go so quickly. It would crescendo, 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 drop, like a wave, like crescendo, 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 drop throughout the film. But coming out of it, I really enjoyed it, and I thought, and it was, I thought that, like, for instance, when, like, the lights came on, the headlights came on, I thought that was a pretty strong moment. But there were, I had a, quite a few times in this movie where I felt it dragged.
I think, for me, when they're going over the bar, right, mm-hmm. I thought it purposefully dragged, because it was one of those moments where, okay, you could show one and or mm-hmm. two, and, like, you get it, it's dangerous. But the fact of, I thought for a moment we would see it even more extended, because that's when you go, wow, this guy's got to do this for forever. X amount of hours.
I felt pummeled, mm-hmm. like, yeah. because oh, yeah. of its length. And I did remember what it was that you had said. And again, it was in a Rolling Stone reviewer. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Rolling Stone or Entertainment Weekly. One of those gentlemen had written, I think it was Entertainment Weekly, now that I think about it. He called the movie, this is disaster porn made safe for families by Disney. And I'm like, no. I don't know what movie you saw, but this really isn't a disaster movie. It's a rescue. It's no more a disaster movie, I think, than Top Gun is. Mm-hmm. This was a true event story that actually happened. It was about a really raging storm, and it's a rescue attempt. It's a throwback adventure movie. Mm-hmm. You can even, to an extent, call it a thriller. But he called it disaster porn, which I took great offense at.
Yeah,
there was no porn in the movie. I wouldn't know.
I wouldn't say that. I think that's a little drastic. I think that the certain plot lines to me, for instance, you had side characters, like there was the member of the Coast Guard who was too sick to go out.
Right.
And he had like three scenes, and he didn't affect me at all, so I didn't need him. There was also another storyline, and while I liked the fact that Chris Pine's character had this previous kind of, I guess, failure mm-hmm. in the Coast Guard, we spent a lot of time dealing with secondary characters of his relatives. We dealt with, like, a wife of that wreck. We dealt with a brother of one of the people who got lost in that wreck. And it was a lot of the homebone story. And I thought that was going to escalate more or comes more full circle in the end. And it kind of dropped off for me to the point that it felt time-filling. Like, because we never saw, we deal with, in the beginning, you have this guy who kind of is like, to Chris Pratt, not to Chris Pratt, Chris Pine's character, like, this is your fault, I lost my brother. And then he kind of has this strange regret when he's dealing with Miriam about how much blame he's put there, but it never comes back.
But I think that's what would have made it over-the-top Disney and quote-unquote Disney porn or disaster porn, whatever the hell the term was.
For it to come full circle?
Yeah, because then it would be like, you know, you could imagine that scene of like, hey, Bernie, I'm so sorry. You are a hero.
And I agree. Right.
Like, and okay.
I didn't really want it in the end, but that made me not want it in the as much in the middle or the beginning. It was put in the beginning, the middle, and not the end.
I think him and with Miriam, right. that was the moment where, you know, seeing her worry
right.
and understanding that Bernie, whether he's doing this to mm-hmm. redeem himself or he's just doing this because this is always mm-hmm. his job,
right.
he's making that arc for himself, and I'm in. I'm done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was fine. Yeah, I mean, in fact, that was actually, I appreciated it, again, because it gave something on the mainland for us to focus on. And it gave us a human drama element that, again, I thought was wrapped up, that did come full circle between that, you know, in that scene. The woman who played that gentleman's sister, too.
Yeah.
I felt that those were, it's like, when you realize who she is, you're like, ew. Okay.
Yeah,
I sort of kind of get that. And I was drawn in because, again, I think that the way Holiday Grainger played the character of Miriam, that scene with her worked. And I thought, it didn't bother me.
Yeah, and I guess for me, the thing is that with Miriam's character, I always believed her stakes were kind of so high about his job.
Right.
It never felt like for me that she like fluffed off him being a Coast Guard. It seemed like from the very beginning, because of her determination and because of her talking to his superiors, it always seemed that she knew he could he could die. He could not come back. It was that stakes for her. So when she met this other woman who had lost someone, it didn't, for me, raise anything for her because she was already there. She already knew the dangers. And so to make them more real didn't make them more real because they already seemed real to her.
Yeah, and I'm not – see, and I would just go by, and again, like, this is her first experience dating a Coast Guard man, like being with a Coast Guard man. So I'm not entirely sure that those stakes were quite spelled out where it's right in front of her that this is a family that was that has suffered through the tragedy when the Coast Guard unfortunately wasn't able to help a seaman or something. So, I mean, I think she understood the stakes, but she realized what those stakes really were because of those characters. And now being put into the Coast Guard, like, she had this hard time understanding. That's why she's in the... Why did you send them out? There was no need. You didn't have to call them back. And there was that... I thought that was a really great scene where she just kept on saying, call them back. And he's like, get out. He's like, call them back. Like, call them back. And then when she finally sort of breaks down and walks out, I felt her sadness. I felt her fear. And to me, that, again, she played it great. It was a really solid scene for
me. Yeah, I really enjoyed that scene because, you know, that didn't happen in real life.
Right.
And but I liked how she played it and how she delivered the lines because she never once lost her cool. And she just said it the same every single time she said it. And you could just see the moment of defeat.
Yeah.
And but it made it seem so real that she's, like, just genuinely concerned for her man and for, you know, all the guys.
Yeah.
That just to come back. And I, you know, and again, I think that also just, like, gave her character some empowerment because she's standing up to an authoritative figure and telling them to go against commands. Like, no woman does that, especially in that time.
Let's talk about the captain because he was very disrespected. I mean, and I want to take, I want to, from your perspective,
Eric Dimitri,
because you've read the book, and I feel like they made him too, this is the part where they made him too villainy. Just because, like, I get that, you know, and you and I spoke about it before going on of, like, okay, well, that was his job to make them go out. And there's a difference between doing your job and being strict about it and then just being an asshole.
Yeah.
Which I felt he was more on the, he just, we need a villain, so he's going to be more of an asshole.
They also did the same on the Pendleton where you have the other villainous or villain type character who is the one leading the mission to the lifeboats.
To the lifeboats, yeah.
And both of them, for me, were a little bit like, okay, you can calm down and we'll get the point of this.
You know, in the book, Eric Bana's character, he emotionless. Like, he, it wasn't like he was necessarily, like, villainy, but he did come off as being stern, and he had to check his emotions, and he didn't, like, this is what, this was his job, this is what he had to do. He's a commanding officer, and, you know, when I was reading the book, I remember going, well, geez, yeah, that's sort of cold. But that's the way that character is. I mean, he was a sort of kind of a cold character to begin with. And there wasn't – I actually thought the movie version, at least towards the end, showed that he had a little bit of warmth and heart. Because in the book, he comes off Clough, I believe is his name. And, you know, he was a bit more colder towards, you know, it's like, no, you got to go out. You got to do this. And whether you come back. And again, it was great having them, having the Coast Guard people here because there was no technology. They had no idea really where the hell they were.
Yeah.
They had no idea whether or not they made it past the breakers. I mean, them coming back, everybody was like, oh my, what? So that to me
and
is
they came
a
back
story.
Over the bar.
Yeah, and they came back over the bar.
Surprise!
And that to me too is, he's pretty much, he knows that he, at that instant, was sending these men out to die, pretty much. Nobody expected them to make it past the breakers.
But I didn't feel that weight of it on him. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. There's just times, you know, like, you know, had the story been from his perspective, you know, just even down to a stereotypical gulp of, like, you know, and you gotta go.
Yeah. I felt like he was more affected by people saying he was inadequate than actually being affected that people were about to die because of what he said.
Yeah.
Like, it was more on the insult than on the they might not come back, personally.
Yeah, I would agree. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
One of those scenes, we kind of, like I said, for the most part, we talked about various ones, but I do want to go in depth about the more meaningful ones. So if anyone has one that's jumping out at them, by all means.
I really like the way that they shot it. Oh, yeah. The cinematography, yeah. And going into particular scenes. There was the scene where, you know, they just made that rudder out of the bar and whatnot. And then there's that quick shot of, it's not really quick, but there's the long shot where it goes from man to man to man to man, mm-hmm. saying the same command over and over again. And you really, the audience watching that, you really got the sense of, like, how fast it was going and how... the chaoticness of going from, like, top level all the way down to the bottom. And we got the sense of, like, just how vast and massive the whole tanker was. Really, it was so smooth and seamless. Like, okay, now we're in this part of the boat and we're here. Yeah. And they did it twice in the film, and I enjoyed both times.
My favorite wasn't, it would have made it cheesy had they done this, but when they're like, turn the rudder, we got less than 2 minutes. And if a timer just went there, because by the time it got there, I felt like they would have had 5 seconds to turn this damn rudder.
I agree. Their use of space, of you did feel like you were on a ship. Like, it was one of the biggest strengths. And, I mean, you said it. There was a three-story set, and that is how you get those dynamics. But I thought that the inside the ship life, that felt so realized.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I felt waterlogged a bit when this was done. And I saw this in XD 3D. And I have to say, too, seeing this in the right theater in 3D, where a projector is actually throwing the right lumens, because this I had heard some people who had seen it in 3D, and they said that it was way too dark. And that's usually a symptom of the projectionist not, or the theater not raising the lumens on this bulb. To make it look brighter, because you're wearing 3D glasses, which are dark, so everything has to be. Yeah, it's already a filter. And man, this wasn't a movie that was shot in 3D either. They did that. In fact, that sort of kind of came up during filming. It's like, we're going to make this in 3D, and everybody's like, okay, that's fine. And so the company that did the 3D in this, I thought they did a really good job. It lent itself. I thought, fine to 3D, especially when you're going over the breakers, especially on the Pendleton, on the engine room, where you saw these like huge machinery and this big rudder. I really did like the look of this movie, and got to give it to the cinematographer and the editor by putting this together.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I think one of the... because we also saw it in 3D on IMAX, and I think one of the... big shots that really, the 3D really stood out to me was when all the men were rescued and they were coming back. And there was the slow motion, I don't know what camera they filmed it on, but you saw all the water like slowly splashing in their face. And they're coming back over the bar. And I thought that was beautiful because I felt like the water was in my face, you know, splashing at me. It's like, that was when 3D was really effective for this in storytelling.
Yeah,
like,
I felt too.
Just. It's like, we're in the ocean with them.
Yeah, it's, and as far as favorite scenes go, I mean, I would have to go with, like, definitely going over the breakers. You had said it when the Coast Guard men were here, it didn't get repetitive. And in fact, it became more strenuous. It became harder. And it wasn't just the boat doing this. It was showing the boat, like, get spun around, get on its side. And one of the things, too, that was cool, like, in reading and watching The Perfect Storm, one of the things that is really put in your head is you don't want a boat to capsize this way. You want it. You want the wave to hit the boat.
You don't want the bow to go over the stern.
Right. Or even the other way, but you definitely don't want that, because less of a chance of it ever rolling back over again. Yeah. That happened to this boat, which again is to the testament of the craftsmanship and why this boat was built.
I kept thinking, can you just put seatbelts on the thing? Come on.
Well, how would you like to be the guy in the bow who has to have the searchlight and
he's got something to hold on though.
The guy in the middle, just like
we saw him like just shoot up straight vertically in the air.
That scene. Yeah.
And absolutely. Dimitri, you say you don't want the bow to go over stern. What I liked about that, because that's interesting. I would never have thought that. because when they were crossing the bar the first time, you saw a lot of shots where they, you know, Bernie was making the boat parallel with the wave and then rolling over. I thought that was actually a very good tactic and maneuver to get over every single wave.
And I, you know, those scenes too when the boat would actually sort of kind of torpedo. Like, you know, and they're all holding on for their life. I was on the edge of my seat.
Exactly. I was shocked. I thought going into this that my favorite parts were going to be like, oh, whatever character relationships they came up with. Kind of like, not the fluff around the action, but the kind of fluff around. And what I liked most was the boat action, was the sailing aspect, was what they were doing with the small boat and the Pendleton, all of the action around those parts. It was so engaging.
It was very engaging.
That section
and the
so
irony of irony is like, people saying, well, yeah, it's sort of unbelievable that that boat would be underwater for so long. And it's like, no, that's what it was made to
do. They needed like a disclaimer, like at the bottom, like, guess what? The boat can do this.
My nitpick of the movie, you know that I really love this movie a lot. But my nitpick was the fact that they didn't explain the boat enough. I like, just give it
the
a little
tanker?
Bit more. The 35,500, the CG, like, they didn't explain
how both boats could do what they were doing.
Right, because, like, in the book, the boat plays as much a character as, say, Bernie Weber. And I think they were trying to do that in this movie. I just wish they gave the boat a little more character so that you understood this is what she was built for.
It was one of those things that I agree, and even with the Pendleton, where I was it sounds crazy, but I like was recalling scenes from Titanic to make this make sense, because there's a scene in Titanic where he explains how if the chambers fall, it like if these chambers fill up, the boat will sink, and then you see that the chambers are blocked off in the Pendleton, which is like, oh, this is why it's not sinking. But I had to pull that information from outside knowledge instead of really understanding it from what was going on.
I think certainly for at least this boat, that with Dimitri's criticism, I think Bernie could have been a great person to do it because he's so matter of fact, right? Go back to the point, you like, you know, with Miriam being like, you know, being afraid of the water. He's like, well, just remember, it's just more water underneath. It's just water underwater. So it doesn't matter. And so I think he could have been matter of fact. Well, you know, what if your boat sinks? Well, it's designed not to. So, like, whatever.
Just a little bit more about the boat itself. I think it would have been better for audiences, too, because I think it was filmed. It was really film believable, but some people have said, now it's he's underwater. Like, how's that boat stay in the water for so long and not sink? It's designed that way.
Yeah, it's just something that could have been put in there.
Let me ask you guys this: the mess hall. Mm-hmm. Were you guys perturbed in any sort of way? Because, you know, I've never seen like.
Are we talking on the Pendleton or in the Coast Guard station?
The Coast Guard.
Okay.
Because, you know, I don't know. Maybe I've seen more firefighter movies and you see it on TV more, and I'm not used to the Coast Guard. But it, in many ways, that almost upset me because it was like everyone's just sitting here eating. Yeah. Like, you want coffee? We should probably rescue some people.
Here's
okay, grab some coffee. And it was like, you got people to save. Go.
Well, see, the mess hall didn't really bother me as much because it gave the audience the idea. I was like, oh, there's safety here. They're totally fine and complacent right now. What bothered me more was that everyone was driving outside in the snow and like not the best cars back then. I'm like, you're in New England area, you do not drive out in winter conditions such as that.
No.
And everyone's driving everywhere.
I'm sorry.
No, like everyone's driving everywhere.
Yeah,
that bothered
do.
Me.
No, you do. You do.
No. He's refuting that.
At least they were doing something. The people in the mess hall were like, eh?
No, but I repeat that only coming from Boston. Sometimes a blizzard.
But everyone's driving a blizzard.
Nothing.
It's like it's not like rain out here in L.A. where everybody people drive. That's how they get from point A to B. My thing was is like, how the hell is she going outside without a freaking coat on? Because that it's freaking freezing out there, and they're by like the water, which is extremely cold
wind
in
chill,
Chatham.
Man.
And she doesn't have the temperature in the car. And I can't imagine it was that great in the 50s.
Yeah. So yeah. I love the production design in this movie. Since we've mentioned from the cinematography to the production design, it really captured that throwback, nostalgic feel really of pretty. Movies made back in the 40s and the 50s. It looked good from also, the costuming to the
light bulb
color.
Flashes?
Yes, the light
bulb. Yeah. The light bulb flashes at the end of that movie. I was like, did a camera just go off in the theater?
Yeah.
Like, it was that was really wonderful.
Yeah.
I did like that. I found that predictable, though. When all the cars lined up at the end, I think, Phil, you heard me. I was like, she's going to shine the light from her car. That's the only beacon of light that they have on
land. I thought that's why they were driving there.
I'm like, turn on the lights. That's all you need to do. Turn on the lights. And then, yes, she did. And then everyone's, let's follow suit. Yeah. And I'm like, but the way that they set that up there, and because you go from the boat where, you know, they're all saved, and he's like, let's just hope for light. You know, on the shores. I was like, well, there she is in a car with light.
I literally thought that's why they were all driving there. Like, I didn't think that they were like their just lights were on. Like, I thought that their lights were on for a reason. And then they all turned them off. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
No, I kept saying, I was like, just turn on the lights on. Just turn on the
light. The other thing that I appreciated, though, too, when we're talking about the mess hall, is there was, like, this Coast Guard station. Mm-hmm. Seemed to be all right. So for the people who live in Chatham and Cape Cod, they're locals, and this Coast Guard station, it was almost like a sense of community. Mm-hmm. You know, the people knew who the Coast Guard were. You know, when they walked into the bar, when the Coast Guardsmen walk into a bar with the townies there, they knew who one another is, and so I sort of kind of like the fact that these two older guys. Who, like, you see at the bar at the beginning of the movie, they just sort of kind of walk into the Coast Guard like they're Coast Guardsmen. Mm-hmm. And I believe they're just townies, and they're like, we're going to be here. Like, we want to know what's going on. It's for the good of the town. It's like, we want to be here as a show of support. Hey, can I have some coffee? Yeah. But I respected that piece of community that happened around that Coast Guard station in Chatham. So, yeah, I really appreciated that a lot. Let's talk about the accents. For the most part, I felt the accents. I thought everybody did a fairly decent job.
Except even Chris Pratt.
Well, he wasn't from there.
He wasn't from there.
Yeah. No, but, I like that.
But, you know, we talked about in The Heart of the Sea. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now they need England story.
Not revisit that. Well, but I'm just saying, like, Chris Hemsworth accent, you know. A bad Boston accent, especially to a Bostonian, is nails cat claws on a chalkboard. It can be bad. And I thought Chris Pine did a really good job. Obviously,
I didn't realize it was Chris Pine until the way end. I thought
really?
I thought he was really masked well. I didn't realize it was... I knew he was a good-looking guy. But I didn't realize that it was Chris Pine.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was surprised about... He had a very interesting kind of character choice in this movie where, like, his rule following, his taking that on was really interesting to me it kind of pulled me out for a little bit, but I was like, all right, Chris Pine, I'll stick it with the accent. So I, like, got pulled on. Yeah. But anyone else, like, felt like he was kind of putting on an interest? I don't know.
I think it's more so because a lot of people in today's generation would know Chris Pine from the Star Trek films. Yeah. So he already has, like, that going against authority, going against commands.
He's very aggressive,
a different type of personality that he portrays that's already established in people's minds. And then going to this subdued guy who's very obedient, very soft-spoken. I think that's
very
why people wouldn't expect him in this type of role. But I thought he did great.
Yeah, I thought he did a great job, too, in portraying Bernie Weber. Again, that character was, like, even after this happened, he was not Bernie Weber didn't really talk about it much. And he had been given accolades, and he and the crew had been given awards. He would show up begrudgingly. He would talk to his crewmates, but he was always uncomfortable about taking on the role of being a hero, where he just felt he punched in the clock. It was his job to do. He's not a hero about it. You know, Tiny never made it back. That always plagued him. And in the book, they go into more depth. And I understand. I thought they did a great job of... Because one thing, too, that happened... There were two boats. There were two oil tankers that the same thing happened to that same night. There was this other ship called the Mercer.
Which
cracked in half. And when you read that another... I mean, I remember reading the book going, okay, one boat cracking in half. Boy, that sucks. And then wait, another boat cracked in half? I'm like, how the hell are they making these boats? They go into the design and why this happened. It didn't bother me. They mentioned the Mercer. That's where the A-Team goes, yes, off of Nantucket. It didn't bother me that we didn't go to the Mercer, because the Pendleton here is the story.
I'm so glad we didn't go to
the Mercer. I'm glad we heard about it. But in the book, there is a lot more detail, because more men actually lost lives in trying the rescue attempt to the Mercer.
And I think what came across really well for the movie was the fact that I could see Bernie being upset by this, is that every rescue is just a rescue, right? Mm-hmm. And that there's no like emotion attached to that. And you know, just because one may be harder than another, a rescue is a rescue.
Yeah.
You know, and so to hold this one as, for him, the greatest one, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny, too, because, like, in an action movie, even them taking out the boat, like, they just would have been way more, everybody hold on! And Bernie Webber's just like, okay, he's very quiet, stoic,
and
concentrating on his job, not only his job, but his crewmates, and trying to assure that they're safe. And so that, to me, is another aspect when you talk about this isn't a larger than life movie.
I laughed when the two of them finally got on that boat, right? And you would expect this whole like, oh, thanks buddy, hey buddy, right, how'd you survive, oh, you know, how'd you get here, oh, you know. Right. And like, but it was just like, it was almost the equivalent of a head nod, that just two people that just do not speak, very matter of fact, and just all about get the job done.
Get the job done. Mm-hmm. Get the job done. And that's another thing, too, that I liked the way that Casey Affleck portrayed that character. You know, he was a sort of matter-of-factly kind of a guy. And I always got the sense, like, when he wasn't talking, you always got the sense of that character was thinking. Mm-hmm. How do I keep this thing afloat? And how do I keep these men safe and not doing something stupid like try to get a lifeboat out?
But with an axe.
With an axe.
He did waste an egg, though.
Dimitri, you did mention, you know, during the book that you read, it goes more in detail why the tanker, both of the tanker cracked in half. And, you know, I was doing research after the fact, and I found something, like, actually very interesting for the audience who may not know.
Yeah.
This is a little lengthy, but I'll read it really fast. The SS Pendleton had suffered a three-way fracture the year prior.
Right.
But it was never repaired. But surprisingly, the hastily built World War II era ship had still passed the Coast Guard inspection in January 1952, 1 month before that disaster happened. And then subpar welding methods used in ship constructions were mainly to blame. It was also likely that the hull of the ship had been constructed with dirty steel, quote unquote, which means that it contained too much sulfur and therefore was weaker. So as a result, the T2 tankers, like the Pendleton, were sometimes referred to as Kaiser coffins or serial sinkers, which I found very interesting. So it was shoddy metal that they put together in these tankers.
And the shipping companies who built them never lost. They won that, like, they never, there was no,
there was nothing they had to pay for.
Whatever. They weren't reprimanded. They didn't have to pay for anything.
It's also just, the idea that a tanker just breaking in two, and then there's two of them. That's not a coincidence. That's a maintenance issue.
Again, I remember, and again, the book is referred to me. It's about 200 pages, at least on my Nook. It's a very easy read. And again, when I found out that there were two boats that split in half, I was like, holy
crazy.
And again, the ferocity of the storm in which they're talking about as well. But was it in the movie, I liked when they talked about the boat whistling. Like, remember how, like, and he's like telling the captain, like, I hear it's howling at the seams. He goes, it's not a good sign. And that was, to me, that was really good sound design.
Yeah.
Where we saw it. You talked about sound design. I don't know, like, where I saw it, it was like this immersive sound. Especially, I loved it when they were approaching the breakers. And you sort of, like, you sort of heard the thrumming of the waves, the thumping. And even Weber said, the breakers are off, you can hear them. And then it started to get a little louder as it would go. And it almost built, like, it was almost orchestrated like the theme from Jaws. Like, it was like, doo-dum, and then it'd get louder and louder until finally that first wave hits, and you're like, oh my god.
Yeah. Yeah. Very loud.
Yeah, the sound effect, the sound design for me was great. I didn't have the same experience.
I liked the moments. Like, there, I do like the details, like the humming, those things. Just for me, the sound was just crazy variations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it would escalate and escalate and escalate, and then instead of decrescendoing, it would just drop.
Right.
It, like, there was no kind of, like, arc to get your eardrums ready. It would just be going, crash.
Right.
And then we would go to a really quiet scene. So to me, sometimes it was a bit jarring. Right. But I liked that the sound grew because I was, like, getting more enthralled with it. But then it would just, like, disappear, and I'd be like, whoa, shake it off.
Let's talk about Craig, the director, because initially it was Robert Schwenke who did the Divergent mm-hmm. movie, and that's why he had to pull out. When Craig Gillespie, you say his name, you know, I haven't really known him, but I do like his work, Lars and the Real Girl, Fright Night. So, and I think this is really kind of the next level for him. I really respect what he managed to do on this movie.
Yeah, yeah, he just came off $1 Million, which is a Disney movie. Yeah,
I think he's becoming a Disney go-to because, number one, it's interesting because Million Dollar Arm, again, is another throwback to that mm-hmm. live action feel good kind of mm-hmm. sport movie. Again, another story based off of a
true story.
He was now tapped. He's in pre-production, I believe, for Pete's Dragon. So another remake of a classic Disney story. I agree with you. I mean, this is a guy, he can direct in that Disney fashion. And it's almost as if he himself is a huge fan of those throwback Disney movies. And he's able to craft that feel-goodness, that family-friendly, mm-hmm. that audience-friendly movie that Disney is akin to making.
Yeah.
That's sort of a lost art that Disney's sort of kind of like
outside of. I don't know if it's a lost art or Disney's just been like, this is us. Everyone make everything else.
Well, I agree, but you don't. Because nobody else would attempt this. Like, if this were maybe another studio, they may have said, now we gotta make the waves bigger. I can just see somebody going, mm-hmm. we gotta make this bigger. We need bigger splashes. I want them off the boat and being dragged.
Instead of 50 foot spells, we want 75.
I think it would have been a lot darker. Yeah. If you don't have Disney make this, I think that most studios would choose a narrower audience, mm-hmm. mostly male, and it would have been about how dark is this, how intense is this. I think we would have seen the death that our Coast Guard friends mentioned, much more brutal, versus like Disney does go, no, we're going to take a movie that surrounds a disaster and a rescue, but we're going to give you the assurance that you can see it and as a family enjoy it.
Yeah.
Versus, I think when a lot of studios approach that, if you have giant ship crashing, you don't have that automatic. There is like, oh, well, could I take my kids to this?
Yeah.
Is this for me? Versus Disney kind of almost like buffers you into feel safe.
Yeah, and again, it's a throwback to their older family adventure kind of movies, and I think that Craig gets that. And like I said, it just seems that he is a Disney go-to guy for this type of thing. And that's why I was a little bit offended by that one reviewer that called this disaster porn made safe for the family by Disney. And again,
I mean, part of it, we could talk about, like, how to get yourself out there. But, like, okay, so the fact that we're talking about it, we're just talking about a headline, and that's what it's going for.
Well, but it's so missed the point of this movie.
Headlines also do affect things, though.
Yeah. True.
And I think headlines affect what people watch this, how long it stays in theaters.
To an extent, it does. And it gives a message that this movie is like too clean or safe because it even says made safe.
When I hear the word porn, safe.
I wouldn't say safe. I think it's great that Disney was a part of this because if you think about it, this was a positive movie.
Absolutely.
It had a positive outcome. Who does positivity better than Disney?
True.
I mean,
no, true.
Disney literally is the happiest place in the world.
Yeah.
So, if anyone to do a story that has a great positive outcome, it's Disney.
And film it in such a way and have a director who has, you know, who's able to, he has the talent, the gift to bring out a human emotion and not make it larger than life, because he knows that there are people that he has to respect in this, mm-hmm. the true life people and how they are. So, like, when you look at Bernie Weber, you bring up a good point, because he's so quiet. He's an mm-hmm. inner guy. That's not how we see action heroes of today. You know, or even of the 80s, when you watch like a Schwarzenegger action movie, he's larger than life.
Yeah.
Where Bernie Weber's just the guy. He's a blue collar guy.
He has a timidness to him.
Yeah.
Like, very reserved.
And so, yeah, and they respected mm-hmm. the character, and they respected the story and the actual rescue attempt. And you're right. Had you seen a guy's head mashed up again.
That's well, we did see him die. You know,
you
I
did
think
see him die.
I was like, oh, someone had to die.
Yeah.
I think it's just unfortunate because, you know, the actor who plays them, he was in ER for so many years. So, like, I love ER, and he plays the character Jerry, and he's Jerry in ER is like the most lovable guy. Yeah. And again, it was this kind of same thing, the most lovable guy on the ship. Yeah. And you feel something because all the scenes with him, it's like he's always singing, he's always like being the positive person and in a terrible situation. And then even like encouraging his, you know, his crew member to like, his no, you can do it. Yeah. You can do it. You can get down yeah. to that boat. We're getting through this. And yeah. then you see him, unfortunately, 2 seconds later.
That character.
I would argue. Oh.
Go ahead. No.
He's got something. That my favorite character, though, on the Pendleton was the guy who hurt his arm.
Oh, McTavish.
Yes.
Graham McTavish. He's great.
He's loved awesome. Him. Stole the show multiple times for me.
Great stories about they loved him as an actor. That guy's awesome. He was in Creed. He yeah. was the other guy's manager.
He just stole the show so many times for me that yeah. he was one of the only people that I was like, you can't die.
He was great.
If he had died, I would have, like, I would have lost. I'd been like, no. He yeah. was my favorite on that yeah. ship.
Graham McTavish was great. Now, Tiny in the book was really, again, that character, you got a little bit about more about Tiny because, again, I guess for dramatic effect. So when he died, it actually left mm-hmm. some emotional left. Does anybody care of get a Boreal? I have an actual Abraham Ben Ruby story. I mean, he for me, Abraham Ben Ruby, I know him as far back as a great one of the first Fox sitcoms called Parker Lewis Can't Lose. Mm-hmm. And he played this character by the name of Kubiak. And Parker Lewis was a Ferris Bueller type of a story. Corin Demick played him. But Kubiak was this big lumbering guy who throughout all the episodes he would be eat now. Like that was his like little that was his phrase. Well, I actually had a friend who somehow met him, and I was home in Boston, and I was mowing the lawn. Somehow I heard the phone. I come in, and it's my friend who lived out here. She goes, Dimitri, she goes, I have someone who wants to talk to you. I was like, okay. And I get the phone. I hear the phone being passed off, and I hear Dimitri, and I said, yeah, hey. Eat now? And I'm like, oh my god, Kubiak! And he talked to me for like 10 minutes.
Kind of
so
awesome.
He always has a special place in my heart. So when I see him on New York. Yeah, I was affected because as soon as I heard that he was Tiny, I was like, oh. I was like, bummer, I know what happens to the poor guy, but
oh yeah, that was like the running joke with his character Jerry in ER, because if anything happened to Jerry, the whole audience was like, no, you can't kill Jerry, or you know, you can't do this to him, and it kind of like translated with this character. It's like, no, he can't die.
He plays the lovable big guy.
Yeah, he's a lovable bear.
All the time. He didn't die in Parker Lewis Can't Lose, by the way, but
he didn't die in ER.
He plays that lovable big guy really well. And again,
we like this actor.
We're a fan, and that's just my one like you know brush with fame. Mm-hmm. And he happened to be in this movie, and I was bummed when I found out that he was Tiny. But he's a good choice for Tiny because even in the book, he was described as a lovable big guy, and he inspired the men, and he helped those men get off the boat safely and allay their fears. So,
all right.
You know, there we go with Abraham Ben Ruby.
Yeah. Wow. I think it's time to move into closing thoughts before we wrap out. Mm-hmm. Marissa, how about you? Let's start here.
I really, really did enjoy this. I mean, I love Disney, so I'm like slightly biased in that way. But I like heroic stories that have a positive outcome, but also shows like real people doing real things and doing real and being heroes because of that, and people overcoming things that they didn't want to, but it just shows the testament of of character being thrown into situations and overcoming. And that's just, like, the nature of people. When you're, you know, put in situations and you don't know if you're going to make it in the end, and you do, that's always, like, really fun to watch.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this film did that.
Yeah, I think that for me, it's always like this that do make me a Disney fan beyond just their animation. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, they stand up and they do search for stories of heroics, and this one came from a real place. Yeah. The fact that they've reached out and really pulled the Coast Guard on board, I think is really good. All the sets they created, and for me, they accomplished the biggest battle, which was creating a rescue water movie that was intriguing through all of the boatsmanship and the duality, as I mentioned before, great components. So in that regard, and who I think they targeted as an audience, I think that they really pleased who they tried to please, and that's a strong move. Am I going to give this my absolute favorite boat movie? No, I can't, but I did enjoy it.
Favorite boat movie? I don't even know what movie would go in that
category. Boat movies.
You're a big boat trip fan, huh?
Yeah, no. Titanic. No, but like, you know, boat movies.
I love Titanic.
Ocean movies. It's a category.
It's a genre.
Greatest genre ever floated by.
Like a pie and kissed away.
No, I'm a really big. I'm a very big fan of this movie for all the things that we've all talked about. I think it's a wonderful throwback movie. As someone who's grown up watching those Disney movies, it did have a lot of that feel to it. Like I said earlier, this movie could have been in black and white. That's how much of a throwback as it was. You know, we should a little bit talk about, like, you know, 61% on Rotten Tomatoes, which isn't that great. But again, when I hear disaster porn, I'm not entirely sure that critics were figuring, like, we're seeing this, or they just didn't like the fact that it was a throwback movie, which, okay, I get. What's more important, though, the cinema score was an A-. So the audiences that it was going for really, really enjoyed this movie, and I think for good reason.
Yeah.
It has adventure, heart, it's thrilling, and it has regular people who are reserved in a sense. And so I really appreciated that. Paul said something to the effect of, it's Hollywood. No, it's not Hollywood. Like, it really did happen that way. And I'm glad we got them here to talk about
it. It deals with its main character is more reserved.
Absolutely.
And I think it kind of aims at a more reserved audience.
Yeah.
And for them, it does a very nice job.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? To all of the people that voted it badly on Rotten Tomatoes, you know what? Go out and do something. Do your job. Here's the thing, like, again, have some respect for it. Like, is it the greatest movie, you know, in comparison to no, not necessarily. But is it a good movie and you can enjoy it? Absolutely. Like, that. Trust me. Doing movies in January with the Anatomy crew was like pulling teeth because everyone's like, I want to see that movie. So the fact that this movie actually is good in this time period, you know, I think that. And, I don't think just in comparison to that, it just is a good movie.
Right.
Yeah. And it is also timely because we are coming up on its anniversary. It happened on February 18th, 1952. So
but I'm very glad that they didn't try and go against Deadpool.
Yes.
Right.
Just stay away.
Smart.
Yeah, now also, too, we had a picture up of the Coast Guard man, and there was the gentleman Fitzgerald. Fitz, you know, that's what you would call him in Boston. Hey, Fitz. You know, his wife had gone on to say, like, you know, he doesn't consider himself a hero to this day. Like, he'd say it was 3 hours of work that we were supposed to do. And I got that sense from this movie. And that, to me, even makes it a more heroic kind of a movie, because it's their jobs. And I really appreciate that. And he is still alive today. He actually got to see the finished product. And, yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. If you want a kind of analogy for your own personal lives out there as fans, you know, how many oftentimes, like, you get a phone call and you're like, oh, I don't want to pick up for this person. Just be like, ooh, a phone call. Got to pick it up.
Right.
mentality, right? Just that whole shift of, like, ooh, so, like, the phone is meant to be picked up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which I don't do often for Dimitri. Not because I can't.
No.
You'll love that a little bit.
Yeah. That's what I do. Yeah, he sees my name and
definitely not because of that. But anyway, we digress. I think with that, I think we've wrapped up for the most part the main points of the movie.
Yeah.
If there's anything we missed, that's what the comment section is for. You know, whether on iTunes, whether on YouTube, whether on our website, popcorntalk.com. Let us know. You know, I think this is a great movie. Definitely go see it. Take somebody to see it. If you've already
seen it
in
the big screen too,
I think it was worth it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And we have to thank our actual coasties that were here: John, Mike, and Paul.
Can we call them coasties? That's like calling a frat.
They call it
frat. It should be, you know what I mean?
No, Coast Guards.
Coast Guards.
They are representative. They're honorable men.
Yeah, honorable men. They're not not just representatives. They are Coast Guard. They are enlisted officers. And wow, what a job. Like, I mean, if you love TV and movies, like, that to me is like so enthralling, like, because they know their history and they get to use their history for their work to make sure that it's done right.
They got to combine loves.
Yep.
Right.
Combine.
And where can everyone follow you?
At DMovies1701. Support me on Twitter.
At Sarah_Stratton.
I'm at Serafini TV.
And of course, The Popcorn Talk and Movie Anatomy on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you guys for joining us. Check out other Anatomy of a Movies. We've got a lot coming up. In fact, just very, very soon, Kung Fu Panda 3. And we'll see you back next time on another Anatomy of a Movie.
See ya.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.